My job is following our Smoking Cessation 101 is now to give you a sense of social support and social influence 101 and try to get us all at least using some similar terminology and thinking about mechanisms as we go through the day, the next couple of days here. So I want to start with some brief overview of the definitions and scope of social support, social influence constructs, which social support falls under this broader umbrella. Think a lot more about some of the possible mechanisms that might explain why there are effects for social influence and social support on health. Any evidence that we can manipulate support, or that we know how to manipulate support, or that it matters if we manipulate support, and what are some of the challenges or things for us to think about as we move forward in the next few days. So to start with just the basic understanding of why we're here, which is that social relationships affect our health and our health behaviors. That's well established. It's been established for several decades now and pretty robust finding. What is less well established are and understood are what are the mechanisms and the processes that link social relationships to health and to our health behaviors. And the focus on the mechanisms is important because if we don't understand what the mechanisms are, we don't know how to design interventions, because interventions are meant to influence the mechanisms of action, not just the fact that there is social support there. So it's really where we want to focus. So in thinking through over these next few days, what might those mechanisms be, we need to distinguish among several different concepts, one of which is just, do you have social relationships? How many? What are they like? What the structure is of those relationships, their density, whether they're reciprocal relationships or not, and then what happens within a relationship, which may be what we think about more as the social support. It's important to realize that social support is only one kind of social influence process. And so we want to keep that in mind and distinguish as we start using terms and knowledge about what kinds of online interventions there might be. And also to keep in mind that social relationships have both positive and negative effects, and positive and negative parts of them. And as we focus on just the upsides, I'm sure we all know about there are the conflictual sides of social relationships and the downsides as well, in terms of often increasing stress and increasing problems. So keeping the balance and making sure that what we do in influencing social relationships doesn't tip a balance to the more negative side as opposed to what is helpful. Lots of cases where social influences affect cigarette smoking. If you just think through the natural history of smoking, from trying the first cigarette, most of us would say that they're clear cases of social influence. Pressures to stop smoking, where somebody will tell you, please quit, I really want you to quit. Reinforcing people for staying abstinent after they've quit, celebrations and reminding them they're doing a good job, or the temptations to smoke of just being exposed to other smokers and smoking cues. All of those are points at which social processes can affect smoking, both in terms of initiation and cessation. So when we talk about social influence, it's really pretty clear. We're talking about either direct or indirect effects of one person or on another. And when we think about it, there are lots of forms of social influence. It can be persuasive, it could be communications, imitation, norm setting, modeling, just influencing beliefs and attitudes. So when we think about online ways of manipulating social influence or even networks and support, we need to start thinking through all those different levels as well. And when we think of influence, we usually think about we're trying to move somebody. Either you're moving them to trying a substance or moving them to trying to stop. So here's your, you know, psych 101 social psych slide of what the terms are, which just to help think through. People will talk about different kinds of norms, one of which are just subjective norms, or what we think about as social pressure. And that's expectations that people we care about have about how we should behave. Injunctive norms are in a sense of what's approved by others and your perception. So smokers' perceptions that smoking is an approved or a not approved behavior in whatever context they're in. And there are descriptive norms, which are perceptions of how other people are behaving. So if you have a descriptive norm that waves of people are starting to quit smoking, That's one kind of social influence, which is very different from an influence of just a subjective norm or an injunctive norm, which is that you should quit. So all of those can be manipulated. And then also there's this notion of social comparison. People like me, are smokers like me starting to quit? Are smokers like me successful? Or if they can do it, so can I. Well, if this person who is less competent than me or has more problems can quit, why can't I quit? So those are also important notions in thinking of through social influence. All of these norms can be transmitted in lots of ways. We all know about verbal transmission, the nonverbal transmission, where you give somebody a dirty look when you aren't approving of what they've done. But also what are often effective in, or perceptions of effectiveness, you know, anecdotally, are stories that people tell about what worked for them, anecdotes, rituals about, well, here are the ways to quit and what we want to do, role models, the media process. And to think about how all of these are transmitted within a given context. So whether the power of some of these ways of transmitting norms varies depending on, is it within a family, is it within a work environment, a broader cultural context, or an online context as well. So basically, in terms of normative social influences, we all are good at conforming in one way or another, and some people are better at conforming. And the more that we see people behaving in a way, we feel compelled. And even among strangers, we often feel this compulsion to act and behave a certain way. But obviously, those forces are strongest when they come from people we care about and family members or people for whom we have close attachments. One of the issues as we move forward over the next few days is to think about what is the depth or the quality of that link in online networks. It's not the same as a family. And are those less meaningful links, and therefore what are we able to do or how to do? So just to give you examples of social normative and social influence processes, we all know. When in Rome, live as the Romans do. When elsewhere, live as they live elsewhere. Just a common sense of the social influence. Or what happens in my house, another social influence process is the common expression of my son to my husband, "Dad, don't do it, Mom, we'll be mad," which is a very effective social influence process where you have a tighter relationship and it works. So just keep in mind, in the sense of who are powerful others, I wish I had the power in my household, the powerful others in making behavior change or helping people to move one way or another. Culture matters in talking about social influence, and it's interesting to think what are the different cultural boundaries or cultures of online versus in more real world kinds of things. And it's interesting that in more collectivist cultures, individuals may be more likely to be influenced by group norms. On the other hand, the fact is that even in the United States, in a more individualist culture, the power is still there because clearly we're able to have massive impacts with normative influences. Now, just sort of to reiterate what I have sort of alluded to, is that not all influences are equal. And whether or not a process will have an effect depends in part on the impact, on how important the people are to you, how close they are to you in time and space at the time you're making that attempt. So at the moment when you're trying to quit smoking, getting influence from somebody right there at that moment, while you're experiencing those cravings, while you want that cigarette, may be an advantage perhaps of some online ways of going for more immediacy. And then the numbers matter. If you know that a lot of people are going one way, up to a point, you know, up to a point, numbers don't make a difference. So to think about those factors as influencing, as impacting and influencing the probability that you're going to respond. So starting to differentiate terms now. Social influence is a broad umbrella under which there are different terms that are used in different processes. Networks refer to number and linkages between people. So we're often interested in the size or the density. These tend to be structural measures. They're not necessarily mechanistic or tell you about a process. in just describing something as a network. So we know that network size can be related to health behaviors, but we're not sure always what are the processes involved in the size and what that network might be. Social integration is also different from social influence. And so in social integration, we're thinking about the different kinds of relationships that an individual may have, the number. You may be a spouse to someone, you may be a parent, you may be a coworker, you may be a friend, you may be a leader in an organization, you may be involved in your lots of sports clubs. So integration also may or may not reflect different processes. So it may be that the more integrated you are, the more likely you are to respond to certain social pressures through networks that enforce or encourage different behaviors. Social support is yet another distinctive element among social influences. And so when we talk about social support, we talk about resources that people can get from others. And those may be people you can turn to and to talk about your problems. And they may be able to just listen empathically, can provide tangible support, give you specific aid. And it can obviously be a form of social influence where you're supporting somebody by encouraging them to quit smoking, helping them to think through what else they can do instead of smoking in that moment. Buddy-based interventions have been built upon the concept of social support, which I will talk about in just a moment. So what we need to think about in focusing on social support are what are the mechanisms, because it's by influencing mechanisms what we're trying to target in our interventions. So Lee Westmass has a very nice review article that was in our packet of readings for this conference, which provides a pretty comprehensive model of, or at least diagram of, pathways through which social support can influence quitting smoking and motivation to quit. I'm not expecting you to look at this model. So rather, I'm going to just highlight some common processes as opposed to getting us all there and refer you to that model. But stepping back a little and thinking through what does it take, the multiple components, to get somebody to quit smoking. I mean, if you think about what the common ingredients are, you need to know how to quit, you need to know what to do to quit, you need to have certain attitudes to motivate, you need to feel confident, the skills, and to put all these together into a plan. Social influence processes can affect all of these components in the change process, and we just need to think about which of those components you're trying to target and what does that do in your interventions. So when we think about social support, we tend to think about two types that may be relevant in stopping smoking, one of which is general social support and the other is support that's specific for quitting smoking. In terms of general social support, those are resources that we all benefit from in coping with day-to-day hassles and stressors, and that's providing emotional support, people to do things with, to hang out with, people you can go to for advice or can give you specific aid, and people who make you feel good about yourself in terms of boosting your self-esteem and telling you you're doing a good job. That's different from support that may be specific to stopping smoking. And that may be specific information or help that can encourage you to quit, can reinforce the decision, can help give you strategies for getting through that initial cessation and maintenance process. An important point is that these are two different processes that actually have different mechanisms of action, whether they're indirect or direct. So when we start with indirect effects, most commonly we think about the stress buffering effects of social support. And here we're thinking about social resources that help all of us cope with daily hassles or other stressors or how to evaluate them as they come up in our lives. It's important for a couple of reasons. Smokers view smoking commonly as a way to deal with stress. So as you remove their coping mechanism, alternatives need to come in. So social support here to help reduce sense, to help people cope with stress, to make their lives more hassle-free may be effective. Quitting itself is stressful for smokers as they go through withdrawal, as they try to rearrange their lives and their patterns. And so here, just social support to help reduce some of those external stressors is important. So the hope here is that social support helps smokers regulate negative affect so that they have an easier time with quitting and that they are less likely to relapse. We also have a notion of autonomous support as an indirect effect. And here, this is a concept from self-determination theory, where that this is a kind of support, and somewhat like self-esteem support, that helps you feel more of a sense of control, increasing intrinsic motivation. So it may play a role in decisions to quit. In terms of social integration and that broader participation in social behaviors, here you can think about how the differences among the network may help you to quit. These may be pressures to quit, implicit pressures, a sense of responsibility to others if you have greater integration, if you're more central to the lives of a lot of people. Or, as Cohen and his colleagues have found, it may be that less integrated people are the ones who are more susceptible to some of the pressures that happen in the moment, the going out with friends and seeing the cigarettes and having those temptations or sharing cigarettes. Direct effects come from specific behaviors that others can do to help reinforce your decision to quit, to move you to quitting or make the process of quitting easier, so that they can help sustain you through encouragement, through your reasons for quitting, help to discourage smoking when you really want it, give you strategies to cope. And this is often needed right in that initial quitting phase. So in terms of our rationale for them moving into buddy-based interventions, this came from the notion that clearly we have a lot of evidence that perceptions of support and your sense that you've had a support while you're quitting matter. And we know that that's associated with greater success at quitting. Initially, a few decades ago, the notion of doing buddy interventions came out of the problem of relapse. At that point, you know, if we go back to the early 80s, the most common way that we thought about treating people for smoking were in group programs or getting professional help. And of course, people relapsed. One of the original ideas behind buddy interventions was to extend the support and the structure of what happens in groups into the natural environment. The notion is that these are treatment extenders, that rather than people going away and no longer having help and assistance, if we could mobilize and train up the natural support environment of a smoker, perhaps we would reduce relapse. That was the rationale initially for the original buddy-based interventions, was more as a relapse prevention strategy. And of course, it also became more focused on what do you do during quitting. But that, just to keep in mind, that was the rationale to start with, was perhaps as extending treatment beyond and training up people. So lots of buddy interventions got developed to train a buddy who could be a variety of different, a spouse, a partner, a friend, give them information about quitting, to induct them into what their role really is, to try to get people to understand what's helpful to a smoker, what's not helpful, nagging, policing, those kinds of behaviors are not helpful, whereas providing encouragement, support, and specific activities are helpful. Sometimes they involved contracts between a smoker and a partner, and rewards and reinforcers for both, because it's tough for a buddy to help somebody else quit smoking. There's a lot of pressure on them, and there is a lot of flack that they get for helping a smoker try to quit during times. So since the early 80s, there have been many attempts to influence social support and to do buddy interventions. And unfortunately, despite the great idea behind them, we have very, very little evidence that they've done anything. We have a nice review from Cochrane review from Park et al, basically showing that once you look at really more methodologically rigorous studies that have randomized trials, a 6 month or longer follow-up, there is, and looking at the partner interaction questionnaire to see whether or not we've influenced behavior, there's little evidence that the interventions actually either increase partner support or that they work. Similarly, in our clinical practice guidelines, the same conclusion was reached. And then most recently, Lee Westmassenall in their review where they updated the partner-based interventions by finding four more studies that met inclusion criteria. Only two of those four showed an extraordinarily modest short-term effect, and I think Lee was a little more generous in calling them successful than I would have been in calling them successful. But it's important to note that they were also with specific populations, not very generalizable, like pregnant women or just women as well. So, you know, it sounds great. They haven't worked. Why haven't they worked? Let's talk about methodological and conceptual interventions. In terms of methodological concerns, most of the time these interventions have been added on to already rich multi-component interventions. Initially, they were added on to multi-component group-based interventions. So they're ceiling effects. It's maybe hard to go that additional to get a big boost beyond it. The support doesn't last very long. What we've known from other studies that track support over time is it fades fast. So that initial hope that we were going to provide a treatment extension through the time period of risk hasn't held up because we're not changing behaviors other than in that immediate quitting phase. We haven't been able to engage partners long enough in keeping that support up. It's not always clear that we've actually increased support. There's some evidence at times that we have increased some negative behaviors in conflictual relationships. There are problems about who's included. By the time you have all the criteria, can somebody come to the study of a willing partner? These may be people who have lots of resources anyway and don't need the extra support from a buddy. And we haven't learned our lesson about power, and that's these still are often very small studies. One of the newer ones, at least, said it had like only 82 people in it. So we're not doing a whole lot better for that. There are also important conceptual issues that we have to really pay attention to. One of which is that across a variety of different kinds of studies, the correlation between your perception of support and what actually happens behaviorally or enacted support are pretty modest. And so what we have to know is that it's the perception of support that matters. And so if perceptions aren't necessarily rooted in behavior, or if there's a time lag, then by trying to change enacted support, we may not be making a difference if it's what matters is perception of support. So all of our interventions have been geared to changing the actual concrete behaviors, which may or may not change a perception of support. There's also the potential that perceptions of support are really a personality characteristic of an individual. Again, a sense that you may have that you are accepted by others, you have a better sense of social competence. So if it's a stable personality characteristic and not one that is as easily influenced by these momentary behaviors, again, we're talking about a longer term thing that needs to be changed and may be less amenable to specific behavioral interventions as well. We also need to consider the fact that our support interventions don't look at a dyadic relationship. They have considered the smoker and they've considered the partner, and rarely do they consider the interaction between the two. And so we may have not captured adequately, are we changing the relationship as opposed to looking at specific behaviors? So we need to remember that perceptions of support have multiple determinants, and those involve the social environment, the context within which they occur, the personality characteristics of the smoker, their interaction. And each part may be a useful part to intervene on, rather than focusing on just perhaps the specific behavior of the buddy. So perhaps our support interventions have not been effective in what they've targeted, or that we need to target a broader part of the relationship. And then, again, we need to think about the potential for backfiring these support interventions. So there are problems in changing existing relationships. Many smokers, when you need these buddy interventions, are concerned about this message that, you mean I need help? I'm, you know, not so good, and you're telling me I'm ineffective, I'm not good at changing myself. What does this imply about me? And also to think about, just as there are waves of people who quit together, there are waves of people who relapse together. And that these effects can work both ways, and what you need to consider. And we need to consider moderators. There have been effects for gender, ethnic differences in how support is operationalized, which are very important and we haven't even discussed. And clearly there are age and cohort differences as well. So as we move forward, some things to think about. Online support interventions actually have the potential for overcoming some of these problems from buddy-based interventions. They don't necessarily interfere with existing relationships. So the good and the bad about they may not be as relevant to individuals or as close and meaningful, but perhaps then therefore you don't have to worry about the downside of what can come from them. You have a large pool of buddies to choose from, and you can work at multiple levels on beliefs, on information, on modeling, coming up with people who are similar. But there are disadvantages, because the same thing to think about. The relationships may not be as valued, they may be less influential. And the other thing is stuff happens fast online. And so you have to be able to react quickly and track that quickly. Also, as we move forward from a research perspective, we need to think more clearly about what are the important processes we should be measuring. What aspects of all of those aspects of social influence actually change as through some of our interventions? What are the time and space constraints? Quitting smoking is a process. Are we just still focused on that immediate, or perhaps it's looking over time at what happens among ex-smokers or people who've quit? And how do we track those connections? We need to think about operationalizing our interventions at all these multiple levels of support, and then who do we target? Do we target smokers? Do we target potential partners? Existing relationships? New relationships? Those are all dimensions to think about in making these more effective. I guess it told me I'm out of time. Is that what happened? It did. Is that really what happened? I just had cartoons after that.
No, that was not supposed to.
That's clearly no. It's a real, shutdown. Your time is up.
Maybe the battery ran out.
No, the whole thing shut down.
Sorry.
So you missed my cartoon slides, which I had to search high and low for and took more time than the rest of the time. Anyway.
Take a couple questions.
But that's it. We got through the gist.
Questions, comments? There's quite a lot of guys being lectured to in this morning, so please feel free to take these few minutes, 5 minutes or so, to begin to stimulate some thoughts about this session, to sort of set us up for the afternoon and the more extensive discussion that'll happen tomorrow. Wait, we've got a question.
I have a question. Thank you. I think all the power went out.
Just turn it on. That's all. Just...
Anyway, Robin, thank you for that great summary of social support. One of the things that we're struggling right now with interventions that we're trying to develop within NCI has to do with specifically what age group we're trying to target, and a very clear sense on our part that the impact of online social support may be massively different, even within fairly tightly conscribed age cohorts. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
I'm less, these are now just thoughts, they're not data-based, as opposed to perceptions of what it is. I think that clearly younger groups have a very different perception of friends and networks and who they go to and how they go to for support, and I think that is very much there are age effects. But there also seem to be very active online groups among middle-aged adults as well. So I think they actually can be equally effective across. Larry had a question. There's my cartoon. Oh, so this is the obese individual who saying that he needs to get new friends. And then the other one, which is that guy is sitting with his beer can. My friends are making me fat. And his wife said, yes, your friend Bud, for example. And that was...
Great cartoons. Thank you. I'm for those of you who don't know me, I'm Patty Mabry, Office of Behavioral and Social Sciences Research, otherwise known as OBSSR at NIH. And great talk, Robin. I learned a lot. Thank you so